Everyone's looking for a way to keep on burning oil and coal without all the carbon going up into the atmosphere and causing climate change. We've heard a lot about carbon dioxide capture and storage, or CCS. These technologies are still being investigated, but they're ways to grab the carbon dioxide out of the smokestacks or perhaps even out of the fuel before it's burned and storing it somewhere where it won't be getting up into the atmosphere. The storage ideas so far involve pumping it back down into oil fields or other underground caverns, or perhaps dumping it in the ocean where it may stay for 100 years or so. So we're about to hear selections from the presentation of the IPCC Special Report on Carbon Dioxide Capture and Storage. The IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This presentation was held as a webcast on the 26th of September 2005 in Montreal, Canada. We have on the program, as we will hear, Dr. Pachuri, the IPCC chair, Dr. Davidson, the co-chair of the Working Group 3, and Dr. Bert Metz, the co-chair of Working Group 3. Most of what you will hear is from Dr. Bert Metz, who seemed to handle the heavy hitting and also has the clearest English accent. At the end, we hear a couple of questions from reporters as well. So we're just taking bits and slips of this so that you'll get an idea of what the IPCC is saying about carbon dioxide capture and storage. Is it workable? Is it coming anytime soon? Or are we just going on for unregulated and unstopped climate change?
Today we are going to launch the IPCC Special Report on Carbon Dioxide Capture and Storage. We have journalists here with us in the room. We're also being webcast at ipcc.ch. And you'll also find a press release by UNEP and WMO, the parent organizations of the IPCC, on their websites, which are unep.org and wmo.int.
Which brings us to the item of what does this cost, which is not unimportant, as you can imagine. We analyzed what would it cost in terms of additional cost for electricity produced in power plants if you add a system of capture and storage to that plant. The difference between the situation without and the situation with capture and geological storage is roughly $0.01 to $0.05 per kilowatt hour. It depends on the type of power plant you look at. It also depends on the country, the relative prices. There are various factors that lead to quite a range.
In fact, if you take the average over day and night over a year, and you think in terms of the power consumed on average by the planet, we consume about 13 trillion watts. Day in, day night, averaged over a year. The United States consumes about a quarter of the world's energy right now. We consume about 3 trillion watts to power our lifestyles. If you read our National Energy Report, you'll read this number in an archaic unit, 99 quadrillion British thermal units per year. But if you trust me, I've done the arithmetic, that's 3.3 terawatts.
One way to make carbon dioxide storage cheaper is to pump it down as a kind of a slurry gas into old oil wells. This will force oil from wells that were almost depleted to come up to the surface so that you can make money from what you're pumping down in storage.
The bottom part of the table shows you what the cost would be if you put the CO2 in a geological storage, but in the form of using it to have enhanced oil recovery, which means you put in CO2 and as a result you get out more oil. So the additional revenue from the oil lowers the cost compared to a normal geological storage operation. And then you get sort of a benefit of 1 to 2 cents from that, which narrows the gap between without and with. As you can see, we refer to geological storage here in particular. It's clear from what my colleague said that the our knowledge and experience with geological storage is much farther ahead than for ocean storage. Ocean storage, there's not much we can say about the practical implementation and the precise cost, although we do have estimates of what we think it might be.
But will politicians force big carbon producers to install this technology?
Yeah, I showed you the cost in terms of additional cost per kilowatt hour. Policymakers, when they decide on reducing emissions, for instance, in the context of the Kyoto Protocol commitments, they have to choose between various things. And for them, it is important to choose the cheapest options first. And normally, they want to know what is the cost per ton of CO2 I can avoid. And so we present also in this report our cost in those terms to allow policymakers to make those decisions. And this is the dollars per ton avoided for various situations. Again, there's a difference between just geological storage in the underground or using EOR to drive out additional oil. Normally the costs come down. There's still quite a range. This is not the cheapest thing around. There are definitely other options to reduce emissions that are cheaper, and it's also not the most expensive. So it has, in that sense, it could help to lower cost of the overall action.
Are there enough empty holes in the planet to put all the carbon dioxide we produce?
The next important question, of course, is there enough storage capacity available? Where can we put it and how much can we put there? The assessment is that for geological storage, there is conservative estimate that it's at least 2,000 gigatons of CO2 total. For reference, that's about 80 years of the current global emission. Of course, these emissions will rise in the future, so then it will be different. But that's quite a substantial amount. For industrial use, as indicated, it's basically negligible. For ocean, given the state of development of our knowledge, which is much less advanced, we can only do some modeling calculations, and the conclusion of that is it depends on what kind of assumptions you make about how much CO2 there will be in the atmosphere and how much limits you want to use for changes in the acidity of the ocean. But the number could be big. Mineral carbonation fixing CO2 with minerals is too early to say something. It's further ahead.
We would need to build thousands of new storage facilities. It's a whole new industry we're talking about.
Technically, it might be feasible, but how do we look at it from the economic point of view? What is cost-effective, given what certain assumptions of what we might have to do to address the climate problem, as well as what the relative cost of CCS is compared to other options? Now, studies that have done these analyses say economic potential can be quite big, somewhere between 220 and 2,200 gigatons, again, cumulatively over this whole century. To give you an idea, that is in the order of 15 to 55% of the total effort that might be required in this century, depending again on what the policy decisions would be and averaged over a number of possible targets for the future concentration. Then, of course, the next point is, how do they compare? And what we see, if you remember the number of 2,000, that was the technical assessment, conservative estimate for geological only, and this high end of the range is 200 to 2,200, we conclude it's likely that even the high end of the range can be met by just the storage capacity for geological storage. However, and we want to highlight that as well, that's not a simple task. This will be several hundreds to several thousands of quite big, large-scale CO2 storage and capture and storage projects over this century to be installed. So it's by no means a minor operation. Looking at this role of CCS in the total package, the conclusion is clear over time, assuming that policies will lead to further reductions, the role of CCS will increase. And also, quite importantly, the cost of a package of actions, including CCS, could be 30% or more lower than a package of actions where you exclude CCS. So bringing it in gives you the opportunity at least to do these things at a much lower cost.
But what are the environmental and other social risks of doing this carbon capture and storage technology? We're going to get an answer here from our major speaker, and then I'm going to slice in a second question about that from a Canadian reporter and the response so that we have the whole risk picture together such as it is. Now, all of this presumes that planning works, that humans do the best they can, that there is no terrorism, and that strange accidents don't really occur.
The other big question basically around this technology is what are the risks? There are various components. First, there is the pipelines. There is substantial experience with these CO2 pipelines, and our assessment is the risks are comparable to where we even have much more experience, that's hydrocarbon pipelines, oil products, chemicals, gas. So that's not a really new thing. Geological storage, the main option actually that is emerging out of our assessment, is a situation where we say, well, if a number of conditions are fulfilled, namely appropriate selection of the specific sites based on good information about the geological situation, a good monitoring problem to detect any irregularities, a good regulatory system, and the availability of methods to stop a leak if it would arise. If you do apply all of that, and there's a good basis to develop those things, then we could say the local risks are comparable to what we do already at a fairly large scale today, store natural gas in the underground and house oil recovery, or what is very popular in Canada is underground disposal of acid gases. So there is an extensive experience, and we say under those conditions these risks are comparable. On ocean, again, it's a very different situation. Our knowledge is much, much more limited. We know about impact of CO2 and as resulting change in acidity on organisms, laboratory and small-scale experiments, but on the ecosystem level, how that affects the ocean ecosystem, where there's basically no information. On mineral carbonation, it's clear that this would require massive mining operations to get the minerals with all the basically well-known environmental risks involved.
We'll go back to the floor here in Montreal.
Yes, my name is Isabelle Montpetit from Radio-Canada. My question is about the health and safety hazards related to pipeline transport. I would like to ask you to qualify that risk, because I was a little surprised to hear that it's comparable to transport of petroleum or gas, which are explosives. There's a fire hazard too. So how can CO2 transport compare to hydrocarbon transport?
You're right in the sense that CO2 is a different substance. It's not explosive, but it is toxic, and it is denser, heavier than air. So if you have a leak, it will stay on the ground. So that means it's a substance that you have to be treating very carefully. On the other hand, for gas pipelines, the toxicity is not an issue, but the explosiveness is. But risk is a combination of probability and impact. And so therefore, we are able to still say these are comparable or even lower risks when you talk about CO2 pipelines.
You'll notice the professor is saying carbon dioxide is toxic to humans and other animals and life, and it hangs close to the ground like a poisonous chemical gas would do. These are the kinds of risks that come from these plants and from the pipelines and possibly from leaking storage facilities. It's no small matter. We're trying to grab the carbon dioxide and stuff it away underground or in the ocean, but the scientists know that a certain percentage will continue to leak out into the atmosphere and still be a problem for climate change. They figure with underground storage, providing nobody fools with it and everything's built perfectly, about 5% of the carbon dioxide will be released over the next 100 years. In the ocean, the figure may be as high as 35% released over the next 100 years. So is this practical?
Now, when I've discussed the situation of geological storage, the question, of course, is if we would assume that it's not completely secure, that some of that material would leak out over a longer term, would that still mean that this is a good option for climate change mitigation, for reducing emissions? Should we apply it? What we know, and that is what this report says, is that based on our current knowledge of analogous situations and of ongoing projects, we can say that it's very likely, and when we say very likely, we mean between 90 and 99% certain, that the material, that 99% will stay there at least 100 years. And if you want to extend it to 1,000, we have to reduce our sort of probability statement to likely, but then we say 99% can stay over 1,000 years, which is, of course, not giving absolute certainty. That's not possible, but this is a good indication of the level of comfort that the authors had in saying what would be feasible. In ocean storage, if it would be considered, the situation is different. When you put CO2 in the ocean, even if you do it in very deep layers, people are talking about 1,000 to 3,000 meters below the surface, it would nevertheless gradually come out. There's ocean circulation and it reaches the surface again. We know that, say, from studies, modeling studies, that 65 to 100% will stay for at least 100 years. Now, that's a different category of numbers than the ones on geological. So our ability to say how secure geological storage is much further and much more leads to much lower sort of leakage than our assessment on what the ocean situation would be.
The scientists say it is likely that the carbon will remain in its underground storage facilities after 100 years, but that means it is also possible that it will not, that the carbon produced in this age will be inflicted on another age to damage their climate, our grandchildren's climate. Special thanks to Calvin Jones of Climate Change Resources for pointing out this webcast. He's preparing a new report on the viability of carbon dioxide storage. You can look for that coming soon at climatechangeresources.blogspot.com. This has been a special report of Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.